You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Duarte Geraldino. In the early 1940s, a vocal group of Americans were advocating against a war with Nazi Germany. One of the most prominent members of that group was the pilot Charles Lindbergh. Now, he's best known for making the first solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean in 1927. Here's Lindbergh speaking to a crowd in Des Moines, Iowa on September 11th, 1941.
We are on the verge of war, but it is not yet too late to stay out. It is not yet too late to show that no amount of money or propaganda or patronage can force a free and independent people into war against its will.
Ultimately, Lindbergh did not get his way. But in 2005, novelist Philip Roth imagined a world where Lindbergh prevailed. His book, The Plot Against America, is an alternate history in which Lindbergh defeats Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election and keeps the United States out of the war. Roth's work centers on a Jewish American family in Newark, New Jersey, whose life is turned upside down as anti-Semitism becomes a rapidly growing threat across the country. David Simon is best known as the creator of The Wire. When he first read Roth's book, he didn't consider adapting it for the small screen.
I mean, I thought it was an interesting abstraction, and I thought it was an interesting work for Roth. It was only after the election of 2016 that suddenly it became an incredible allegory for somebody who uses that fear of the other, of immigrant classes, of the outside world, of xenophobia, to retain and master political power.
For Simon, the ascendancy of Donald Trump gave Roth's work a renewed feeling of urgency. This weekend, his miniseries adaptation of the book premieres on HBO, and although Roth died in 2018, Simon spoke to him before he passed away, and one thing that the novelist emphasized, don't make the main characters more religious than they are in the book.
He said this to me in our one meeting. He said, make sure that they're secular, assimilating Jews.
Why is that important, secular
and assimilating? It's incredibly important because the premise that Lindbergh offers and that Donald Trump offers right now when he talks about immigrants and the people that he's othering in a political way is that they're not really equipped to be Americans like we're Americans. You know, these Mexicans, they're all rapists and they're all gang members. And the Muslims, they can't be trusted either because, you know, they don't worship a God the same way we do. And Lindbergh was doing the same thing. He was saying, you know, Jews want what Jews want. They're not really Americans like you and me. And he was arguing that these immigrant classes will never get to the point, unlike us, unlike normative white Americans or people who came from Europe in the earlier part of the 19th century or in the 18th century. They're never going to quite be right as Americans. That's the subtle implication. It's the white nationalism that we see today. And what Roth was saying was, you need to depict people who are assimilating so fast. They're so obviously Americans now that you have to put the lie to that right away. And that's what his book does. And that's, you know, we were very careful to do that. I think there's an early scene where the family is, you see the family at Friday night dinner, at their Sabbath dinner, and they're using basically the rote remaining parts of the Friday night liturgy. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, a couple of single line prayers over the bread and wine, but it's even interrupted as the men of the family start to discuss the Yankee game. you know, the kids trying to say the one line prayer, and they're discussing, you know, whether it was Dickey's home run that won the game for the Yankees, and that was sort of an important moment of they're becoming American. The American stands in front of the Jewish.
So how far do you have to go? I mean, the theme of having to prove how American you are is ever present in your work. But for groups like, you know, Jewish Americans, you know, Mexican Americans, African Americans, how far do you have to go in order to prove that you are American?
You just have to outlast the fear and the hate. That is the standard of the story of immigration. I mean, you know, the know-nothings, this goes back to the origins of the country, but even in the 1840s and 1850s, you know, the fear and loathing of the Irish as being somehow subhuman or certainly not white has an incredible resonance in that time. Now it seems ridiculous to us. The Irish are as ingrained in their Americanism as anybody. And I think that's the inevitability of I think the immigrant groups that are now being used as fodder for political power by this administration and by people who see them as a way of metastasizing fear and gaining political power, they're going to be as American as anybody. It's a matter of time and endurance. And it's a very cynical process, but that's who we are. That's a fear that is as old as the Republic.
Over the course of the series, the Levin family has to contend with the fact that Lindbergh, despite being explicitly anti-Semitic, is actually being accepted by the American public. Here's Morgan Spector as the father, Herman, in a scene from the series.
He's giving permission. He's a goddamn hero. So if he says it, every anti-Semite has permission. The Lone Eagle, he flew across the ocean. He wouldn't lie. He's a great American.
Newspapers and the radio guys, they all lap it up.
Well, they lap it up because it's Lindbergh. Yeah. Coughlin says it, or even Henry Ford, they argue back. No one will go after Lucky Lindy.
Lucky Lindy.
Lucky Lindy.
So how much do you want people to actually make the comparison between Trump and Lucky Lindy?
I have to say, there's no point in doing this miniseries to re-legislate 1940 or to re-argue 1940. We now know what World War II was. We know who Adolf Hitler was and Mussolini, and we know what fascism was. We know what the Holocaust was about to deliver to Europe. The verdict of history is in, and if you were an isolationist and if you made the Des Moines speech that Lindbergh really did make in real life, where he basically questioned the loyalty of Jewish Americans for being opposed to Adolf Hitler, then the verdict's in on you. I mean, there's no point in getting into a renewed argument about whether or not Charles Lindbergh was correct or whether or not fascism was a legitimate form of governance. The point is that we're in a moment now where the same demagoguery is being used on cohorts now that are vulnerable. In 1940, the vulnerable cohort was Jewish Americans. And it really is true to Roth's memory of the time and also to history empirically that Roosevelt really did fear Lindbergh being drafted by the Republicans to run in 1940, that was the one candidate that he thought could beat him. And when Lindbergh turned it down, Roosevelt was extremely relieved.
When you watch your work, I'm looking at the characters from the outside. But from the inside, can you describe what they may be feeling, this sort of pressure that Lindbergh is putting on this particular family? What does that pressure feel like?
That's the heart of the piece. That's a good question. The heart of the piece is to live in the point of view of these six characters. It's the nuclear family, mother, father, two young sons, and then extended to a sister, of the wife's sister, and a nephew. And those six characters confront this historical moment, and they're each asked what it is they're supposed to do. To what degree do you resist? To what degree do you acquiesce? When do you speak? When do you not speak? When do you go silent? When do you address yourself to power? When do you fight? When do you flee? They're all confronted by these emotions and by these choices, as are we today. We live in a moment now where if you're political and if you're sentient, and if you're a citizen of this republic right now, there is a question. There are things going on that have not gone on before in a long time. What's happening at our southern border with families being separated. What we saw 2 months into this administration with regard to the airports and the mayhem of actually having American citizens of color or American citizens who were Muslim having their passports and suddenly seen as less valid and, you know, being trapped in the airport in a dystopian moment. Things are going on right now that every one of us is being asked to respond to. And a lot of us are choosing not to, but that's a choice. I mean, we're all now confronted by a moment where our citizenship is being challenged.
Right now in America, it is false to say that it is only white Americans who support Trump. There are a lot of Americans of color who are very, very pro-Trump. And there was this one character in your work that I was struck by, a rabbi, who appears to support Lindbergh despite anti-Semitism. How do we make sense of that character?
I think John Turturro in playing Rabbi Bengelsdorf, a fascinating character from the book, he accessed something historically that I thought was really interesting. A fellow named Rumkowski, who is, if you're Jewish and you're any kind of student of the Holocaust, you know who he was. He was kind of the king of the Jews in the Lodz ghetto in Poland. And he thought that if he reasoned and if he negotiated with the Nazis, he could, in some respects, mitigate the disaster. And to the very end, until they were throwing him on the boxcar to go to Auschwitz, he was trying to mitigate the horror. And he thought, in some sense, I'm riding the tiger. I'm not being eaten. And in a much less dramatic way, because obviously, we're not dealing with a full blown Holocaust here, or anything remotely to that point. We're dealing with the American dry run of fascism depicted in the book. We're more at 1933, 1934 Germany, but there are people who always believe that the totalitarian impulse can be rationalized and can be negotiated with, and that you don't need to stand up right away when the first person's civil rights are questioned, that there's plenty of time down the road to either convince the totalitarian impulse or the demagogue to abandon their extremity, or there's plenty of time to rescue civil liberties, that fight, you don't have to kill the snake every day, that fight can be put on hold.
Do you believe there's enough time?
I don't know. I mean, there are two things that you need. I'm somebody who looks at democracy as something that is never perfected, that is quotidian. Every day you got to get up. As I said, you got to kill some snakes. You got to argue for the have-nots, for the people who are the most vulnerable to having their civil liberties violated. You have to assume that it'll never be perfected. You'll never get it quite right. There'll never be enough freedom delivered to everybody on a given day. It's never going to be finished work. But the moment you stop doing it, or the moment you lay back, democracy can be lost. And so to have it work, to have this very complicated form of self-governance work, Churchill called democracy, he said, the worst form of government until you consider all the alternatives. to have it work, you need two things. You need a relatively well-educated electorate, and you need them to have information systems where they actually acquire fact. Fact plays as fact, and falsehood plays as falsehood. Those things are in short supply right now.
So on that note, you've written a work that is historical, and yet it is fictional. Right. Some of the characters are fictional. What responsibility do you think writers have when depicting sensitive historical events? And I want to give you some context. We know that last month, the Auschwitz Museum objected to a scene from the Amazon series Hunters, where the scene showed Nazis playing human chess with Jewish detainees.
Yeah, I would have objected to that too.
That never ever happened, but
so much it's appalling enough. If you cannot construct a legitimate dramatic moment using the actual outrages of the Holocaust, why are you putting pen to paper? I found that to be offensive myself. This is a moment where it's cleanly labeled as an alternate history. The singular act of the novel is that Roosevelt does not win his second two terms, that an isolationist who is pro-fascist does win those two terms, or does win the first term in 1940, or the third term rather, and America proceeds apace. It's clearly labeled as what did not happen, and the Holocaust clearly did happen. And so there is a little bit of something, it's violative in a different way. And I have to say, the thing about Roth's book is that his premise that Lindbergh could have won is accurate. Lindbergh did not accept the nomination for personal reasons, but Roosevelt genuinely feared he did. He could have beat him. And that's not an inconceivable thing to say, what if, but to label it as being what if. And there's something that is not quite what if about, we're showing you this Holocaust scene in a nominally fiction film, but we're basically depicting something that really, the camps did happen. Mm. Mass extermination did happen. There wasn't a chess game,
We're speaking, obviously, in the midst of our own presidential election. What do you make of this election cycle and how the Democratic Party seems to be responding to Donald Trump's presidency?
I don't know. I don't know. You're talking to somebody who would, to be honest, to be fair, I would vote for a small petri dish of, angry genital crabs over the Republican nominee at this point. I feel as if I don't really want to get into a discussion about which Democrat I support or which Democrat I think would be the optimum nominee. I am opposed to this administration. I can't be unequivocal about that. If you've heard everything I've said about the miniseries, it's, you know, I can't hide the fact that I stand where I stand. I'm not even engaged in an argument now between about liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. I kind of wanted to believe that I lived in a country where the norms and institutions of the society, of the republic, of the manner in which we all learn to share or even argue over who gets to wield power, where those things were held sacrosanct, where you could rely on your vote being counted properly, where you could rely on the information being conveyed by government in the most basic ways, not to be manipulated for political purposes, where you could rely on people appointed to political positions to be obliged to do those jobs rather than to service a political leader. These are all premises that, you know, I'm old enough to remember when they were accepted to a great degree by the rationalists in both political parties and by Americans in general. Suddenly, all these things are up for grabs. So, you know, again, you could nominate anyone, and I wouldn't, you know, it would not be a contest for me at this point. I feel as if one of our political parties has given themselves over to anti-Americanism.
You are known for The Wire to a lot of people. I just want to switch topics for a moment. And in that show, there was a lot of social commentary woven into the different
in all of, in everything I've done. I'm sort of trapped in trying to strain political argument through drama.
What do you think about that show, The Wire, still relevant today?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's a good critique about how we can't address our problems or even recognize them anymore. We just kicked the can. In that show, the drug war is an overlay, is a dysfunctional policy, and it's something that can't be reconciled with a rational response by an American city in any way. And yet it just keeps going. Nobody can actually call it by its true name. Nobody can admit how much has gone wrong. So I think that's fairly accurate in terms of the inability at this late stage of the republic, I'm afraid, our inability to actually face down what are our real problems, to call them by their real names, and to try to address them in any kind of systemic way. Part of that is the extreme partisanship of our politics. We're very good at politics. We're not so good at governing. Part of it is rooted in our racial divides and especially in our class divides, and in the American fear of its own urbanity. You know, we have a myth in this country that America's real values lie in small towns. No, they
don't buy it.
No, 80% of Americans, more than that, live in major metropolitan areas. You know, cities and their immediate suburbs. We're all oriented to the city. Our economic base is in the city. The GDP comes out of the city. All of our culture comes out of the city. We are city folk. From now to the end of eternity, we either figure out the city and how to live together, or we don't, and we fail. And by the way, that's true not just for Americans, but as a species. We either figure out the city or we don't. And if we don't, we're doomed.
Your work, by the way, you know, obviously in the real world, you write The Wire first, and then you wrote The Plot Against America. But taken together, in theory, The Plot Against America would lead to a reality where The Wire would exist. Do you think that there, if that eventual future continues, The Plot Against America, you would get to a point where there would be situations like The Wire? Or would it be
forward? I don't know. I mean, I think in some respects, if there's a dystopian vision of America where we abandon the complexities of democracy and the struggle to argue every day different points of view and to argue out our pluralism and our multiculturalism, when we get to the point where the dictates from on high carry the rule of law, without regard to anybody's civil liberties or in some cases without human rights, I think we're headed to something very different from The Wire. I think you're headed towards something that it becomes some new version, some new technocratic version of fascism. And I think that's the cusp at which we find ourselves. The idea that demagogues and demagoguery backed by mass capital is going to replace the norms of self-governance in this country. I'm very afraid of that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Simon is the writer and showrunner of The Plot Against America.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.